Welcome back to the Dylan Jamelli podcast, everybody. And I have a very, very special guest today. This, my friends, is Dr. Brett Nolan. He is a world-renowned cardiologist and lipidologist, and I'm just honored and pleased to have you here. So welcome, Dr. Nolan.
Thanks, Dylan. That's very kind. Probably too kind, but I do appreciate it. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, I know you're humble about it, but I mean, you come so highly recommended, and I know firsthand, obviously, just speaking with you now, as I have, so appreciate your time. And so we got a lot of stuff to talk about today, and we have really valuable time here with Dr. Nolan. He's very busy, so we're going to take advantage and get as much info as we can out of him today. But doctor, before we kind of get into a lot of the cholesterol and lipid questions and things like that, I want to get your background a little bit. So why cardiology? Why did you start? What drew you to it? And where did it bring you to today?
Sure. So Dylan, I was born and raised in South Africa, and I did my basic medical training there, and it's great training. I had a great time. I then worked some years in the United Kingdom. Then I moved to the States because I met my wife and, you know, women are in charge. So I moved here. And cardiology has always fascinated me. It's sort of a very interesting combination of procedural stuff and preventive stuff and medical management stuff and people who are well but are worried and you want to reassure them. You know, it's sort of a good mix of stuff. Great amount of data and research that kind of supports what we do, which is very helpful. And then actually as a fellow, I had the opportunity to go to San Diego on a paid conference to the National Lipid Association. And to be honest, I went for San Diego and I stayed for the lipidology. I went to a conference there. I was completely sucked in by this world of biochemistry and lipidology and preventive cardiology, and that's sort of what got me going, and it got its hooks in me. I feel very passionately about preventive cardiology. I see the other end of the spectrum, right? So people post heart attack in the middle of congestive heart failure, it's a terrible world, right? And those people are struggling and suffering.
Right.
And you know, a lot of our world is focused on those people. And, you know, I feel very strongly about pulling a lot more focus onto the other end, you know, finding people and preventing disease and finding early disease and heading it off at the pass, that kind of thing. So, you know, that's sort of where my heart lies there.
So how long have you really been doing it? And talk to me a little bit about like where you're at now and kind of what you're doing with it. And because, you know, you do obviously on hand, but then you do the telemedicine too, which I've obviously done with you. So can you kind of talk about that too?
Yeah. So a lot of that's grown organically, right? So when I left fellowship, I joined a group, which was a private practice. We're in Hartford in Connecticut. And then I remained part of that group, but we actually joined a healthcare system called Hartford Healthcare, and we were part of the heart and vascular units at the institute there. And they've been very gracious. They sort of let me be the system director of preventive cardiology. My day-to-day is in the office, but, you know, you really get the sense that people are out there and looking for, you know, good, hopefully rational preventive cardiology care, right? And so I have people reaching out from sort of around the country, and I do telemedicine work with people, you know, as best I can. And that's it. I sort of plug away in the office. The world of lipidology and preventive stuff and doing advanced lipid panel testing, that really has grown pretty organically, because when I arrived in my area, it really wasn't big, isn't big, really isn't big anywhere, unfortunately. And so I sort of had to, you know, sort of push it out there and push it out there and push it out there. And there's still a lot of learning to be had. And, you know, I think maybe refining how people approach this. But that's my everyday. I see consults. I try and help people out. I do the best we can there.
Right. So just so I can give a little background on how I met you to everybody watching. I have talked about some of the heart issues that I had found out about myself, and Dr. Thomas O'Connor was the one that sent me to you, and he spoke so ridiculously highly of you and said, I absolutely had to come and see you and talk to you, which I immediately said, make it happen, you know, make it happen. Get me to him right away. Because when anything for me, I'm super, super preventative. Like you were talking about the preventative side. I am maybe even overly preventative with how I teach people and everything. So you were just a huge blessing to me to speak with, but just so that people out there know how extremely highly recommended you are and how, you know, busy you are to even get with. And that's why I wanted to get your knowledge here. So I want to do rundowns of different aspects of lipidology. I want to talk about medicines. I want to talk about conditions. But first, just when it comes to the heart in general, because I don't have the statistics in front of me, so I wanted to ask you, is heart failure and heart attacks pretty much now kind of the number one cause of death, world renowned, or at least in the United States, or is it kind of up there at the top?
Pretty much so. So, okay. You know, if you take cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular deaths, if you take all cancer deaths combined and you add all chronic respiratory deaths, there's still more deaths from cardiovascular disease. So it's a bear. Wow. It's the biggest bear. And you know, that's sort of leading worldwide, certainly in the United States. And you know, that's not even counting sort of allied conditions. So if you add in stroke, then the numbers are even higher. And of course, a lot of those statistics capture death, but you could have a big heart attack. You now have awful congestive heart failure and your life is ruined, but you're alive. And so you don't even get caught in that statistic, right? So it's a massive problem. And you know, we only see ourselves getting busier and more demand because it's a big problem.
So do you find the cause of this problem over time has gotten worse? And do you think it's more like, or is it just a combination of like bad diets? Because I feel like over time that diets played a key in this, like the worsening of the food and the diet probably, but then also genetic issues, kind of like what I had found out with me. What do you find, or do you find there's one area or it's just a combination of everything?
Yeah, so that's a fascinating question, and it definitely is a changing landscape, right? So the original classic at-risk cardiovascular person was sort of an older male. He was a smoker and had high cholesterol and, you know, high stress, no exercise. That was like your classic picture. And, you know, this was the days when doctors used to advertise cigarettes. You'd have these advertisements for Camel cigarettes with the doctor smoking and he's dead. You know, these like ridiculous old times. Now, in fairness, the old research also only focused on men. Right, so women were sometimes excluded and ignored in the data. So, you know, with that in mind, but that was your classic at risk. Now, contemporary risk is definitely changing. Right. So we're seeing far fewer smokers. We're seeing more women, and again, maybe that's recognition. Maybe it is more women, but either which way, more women. We're definitely seeing younger people for sure. And what's also interesting is, you know, you mentioned this thing about diet. 100%. Our diet source has become poisoned, right? The well is poisoned. And what people are eating and how people are eating has changed dramatically. And so what we're seeing is this huge tidal wave of metabolic syndrome, you know, be it early metabolic syndrome, hyperinsulinemia, be it prediabetes, be it diabetes. And let's face it, that is largely a diet-driven phenomenon. You know, you can certainly have risky genes that make it more likely for you, but it's risky genes and lousy diet, and that sort of leads to that problem. And so that's now driving our current wave. So, you know, the genetic things you talk about are always going to be there, but now we've layered this other stuff on top, right? And, you know, this is all these things that follow on from this, not just cardiovascular disease like plaque and heart attacks, but things like congestive heart failure, you know, dementia, like Alzheimer's dementia, has a very strong association with type 2 diabetes. You know, a lot of chronic inflammation associated with these things. So we're kind of actually stepping or have already stepped into this fairly frightening new world where there's actually a worsening of our mortality trends for cardiovascular disease and an increase in prevalence. And it feels like we're paddling uphill a lot of the time, you know?
Yes. And see, so this is where my world and your world kind of coincide here, because I'm obviously dealing with people that I'm training often and looking at diets constantly. And then being that I've taken so much time now with the heart and cholesterol and everything, I have spent countless hours on that and then correlating it all together. And I was just having a conversation with my stepson two nights ago about his diet. And, you know, he's 26, 27. But my point to him, and that I want to make to people that I want to run by you, is being preventative early, because this is something that builds over time, right? Like the plaque builds over time and you're feeding it and it's growing, and it starts when you're younger. You might not have it, but you're contributing to it. And then it's just so important to be aware of these things, right? When you're early on.
Of course. Now this is one thing. So I'm fascinated by dietary science and reading so much of dietary science. The problem is most of it is terrible quality data. It's a travesty, because dietary studies are quite hard to perform because they require a lot of money and time. And, you know, if you look at the quality of data that we demand for medication, it's randomized trials. So that means you take two groups, you control what both groups are doing. You know, this, you do this, you do this, and you follow them, and you look at things like outcomes, like what are heart attack rates, etc. Now, those sorts of studies in the diet world would take a very long time, and they're expensive, right? So most dietary science is asking people what they ate by food frequency questionnaires. Notoriously inaccurate. The average inaccuracy rate of those is 30 to 40%, right? So that's like not reporting one entire meal every day. The next thing that is typically done is that is correlated statistically with outcomes. And correlation is not the same as causation, right? So statistically, it might be accurate, but actually mechanistically, it might not be, right? And so people get very confused by diet, and I absolutely don't blame them, because vegan diet is the best based on the study. Oh, carnivore diet is amazing based on the study. No, Mediterranean diet. So how can it be that all of this data goes in different directions? Because it's all of the same low quality data, right? And so, you know, we have to be honest about that. You know, and just draw back and say, you know, based on high quality data, randomized trials of data, one of the strongest things we can say is do not eat to lower your cholesterol. Ironically, this is a dominant message that is out there and pushed by most guidelines, but that was the best studied intervention in randomized trials. And in randomized trials, when people ate to lower their cholesterol, they actually increased their cardiovascular death and all-cause death. And this was studied in you know, primary prevention people. This was studied in post-heart attack people. So diet is confusing, and I fully acknowledge this for everyone. So my general ethos and what I try to explain to people is there is no one diet that is right for everyone. People are very, very heterogeneous in terms of genetics and backgrounds and all these kinds of things, right? And not even just genetics, but epigenetics, like how your genes are turned on and off, right? It's all very complicated. So there's no one diet that's right. If you go for blood work yourself personally and you see things that you can respond to in your diet, like your insulin levels are very high and your blood glucose is high and your triglycerides are high and your HDL is low, blah, blah, you are overeating sugars and carbohydrates. So do less of that. But that's for that individual. Got it. If you see very low omega-3 levels and high omega-6 levels, you address that in your diet. And then the other sort of broad tenet is we ate for hundreds of thousands of years and did just fine. And then we started monkeying around with our food and engineering our food. And so let's take out the fat, but now it's not palatable. And let's give corn subsidy, maltodextrin poured in there. You know, we screwed it up. And so if you are eating, broadly speaking, food as it comes in its natural state, I think it's kind of hard to go too far wrong. And that includes animal meats, right? So if you take a cow that is well fed, its normal diet of grass from its whole life until it's slaughtered, there's probably not any concern about eating that beef and enjoying fatty cuts of, you know, whatever it is. And that is very different from highly processed and preserved salami or, you know, a McDonald's burger fried in vegetable oil. But unfortunately, you know, dietary science hasn't differentiated between those things to confirm or deny that. But again, we just have to be honest about how much the data has shown and how much it hasn't. And so, you know, it's sort of unsatisfying because people want an answer like, yes, Mediterranean diet. And you know, also something I say to people, yeah, there's nothing wrong with the Mediterranean diet. There's not too much wrong with the vegan diet. I'm not a massive fan, but if you yourself thrive on a vegan diet and love it, and you know, it's doing good things for you, great, do that. But what always makes me very sad is I see this is the typical picture of some gaunt middle-aged guy who's had a heart attack, who comes back to the office, whose wife is flogging him to not eat meat and to not eat any eggs, and everything is low fat, and he's starving and miserable, and he thinks he is doing that for the purpose of cardiovascular health. And you know, I always take great pleasure in front of his wife or partner saying, man, it is okay, you can eat this stuff if that's what you want to eat. Just pay attention to the quality. So I mean, again, I think that's as honest as we can be about dietary data.
And see, I'm so glad you brought that up. So as you can imagine, one of the questions I always get is, well, what should my diet be? Well, you know, this diet is this diet is that. And you said exactly verbatim what I tell everybody. It's conducive to each individual person. I cannot give you the same diet I give to somebody else. If I'm being and I'm a certified dietitian. So if I'm actually practicing being a dietitian, I am customizing it and I'm monitoring you. So we're doing, I do like so think about a nightclub where it's one in and one out when it's too full. So I will add something, see how it works, and find out how it sits, take it in, pull it out, take it in, pull it out. Because some people can't even be in the room with a carbohydrate and some people can eat more, you know, and,
correct.
And that goes down the line. So
100%.
It's like what I teach people with supplements too, and they're and any kind of PEDs they use. Everybody's different. Some people are estrogen prone. Some people are not. And it's just, I think you'd agree with me on this. Almost everything in life in general is trial and error, right? I mean, so many things we go through in life. It's trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. And diet is, I believe, one of the biggest trial and errors that there is, because as you get older too, things have to change, right? So I mean, thank you for bringing those points up, because it's very true.
And you know, I also think you have to sort of, in my world, you have to meet people where they're at, right? So I'm sure that you will probably speak to a subsection of individuals that are highly interested and focused and knowledgeable about their diet and are really into health promotion.
Right.
But of course, everyone we encounter isn't like that. We meet some people who are entirely clueless and disinterested. And then sometimes moving the bar for those people is as simple as, hey, drink one soda a day instead of four. Like, do you think you can do that? And of course, is that considered excellent dietary advice? No. But for that person, hey, man, we're moving the needle, right? So, you know, I use this phrase a lot. You know, I talk to people about progress, not perfection, where, you know, you just want to chip away and sort of move in the right direction.
Yes, I thoroughly agree. And that's what it is. It's always, you get a person, and I get this with everything that I do, and they're like, well, this works for me. And I'm like, that's great because you figured it out, but that doesn't mean it's working for the next person. And you're not being diligent and doing, you're not really being credible if you just take what works for you and try to put it on everybody else, you know? So,
I sort of had this revelation the other day, which I'm interested in studying, which is, you know, particularly when new diets come onto the horizon. So, you know, carnivore diet, it's not new, but it's gaining traction and people are interested in it. And some people are doing absolutely phenomenal. But, you know, the sorts of people that adopt these new things are different. They are interested in pushing the boundaries and you know, just whatever. They are thinkers and explorers, etc. And also those people will tend to be more enthusiastic about new things that they're trying. And in the early stages of a new thing, people that don't get on with it will sort of abandon it, say, all right, that's not for me, and move on. So what you actually sub-select out in the early stages of something new like that are sort of super adopters that are doing well. And so there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement, right? But again, you know, anecdotes are not data. And so, you know, always happy for people when they are thriving and doing excellent in one particular style of thing, but that does not mean that it's applicable for everyone. And if you apply that to the broad population, maybe it looks very different, maybe much better, maybe much worse. We just don't know that, right? So, you know, also this sort of, you know, cautious optimism about these things that are thrown out there, I think is sensible, you know?
I agree. And you know what else too? A lot of these diets, they do work, but they're not sustainable long term. And I think people forget that or they don't realize it. And they think they can stay on them forever and you can't. And a lot of times what'll happen with some of these diets, and I'm sure you've seen this, you'll do it, you'll lose a bunch of weight, but you can't sustain it and then you gain it all back. It's not plausible to keep doing it. And you end up worse off than when you started because mentally then you have a breakdown. Right.
So 100%. There's biochemical consequences, right? So your hypothalamus, you know, adjusts to basal metabolite and all these sorts of things. So I couldn't agree more. You know, I try and wean people off of using their weight as a metric. So, you know, that lipid panel and advanced lipid panel testing that you're referencing, it's so fascinating because it can really plug you into aspects of people's health and their diet and how they're doing, right? And so I always try and tell people, look, eat for your cardiovascular health and outcomes and your insulin levels and these things, and your weight is a happy side effect. You know, don't make that the focus. Because I think, you know, that's also one of the problems is there's been a lot of weight focus rather than health focus and diet. And so, you know, as you said, people do extreme diets, they do lose weight. Oh, I'm going on vacation, I want to weigh X. Yeah, that's sort of such a short-term goal because now they weigh X and they're like, I've arrived, and they abandon it, and then no one gains health that way, right? So you want to say, that's the happy side effect. No. Like you're doing this for health and longevity and all these sorts of things.
Yes, words right out of my mouth. Everything I talk about is always health and longevity, health and longevity, health and longevity. Yeah. I want to shift here and I'm going to condense this really quickly. I'm going to explain why I was brought to you and what happened to myself. And then I want to get into that with you because I feel like there's so many things there that I owe everybody to talk about. And you're the person to teach people that I want to teach people.
Sure.
So
sure thing.
In short, when I met Dr. O'Connor, he told me that because I had told, he asked me about my heart and I said, well, I've had every test done. I've had an EKG done. I've had an echocardiogram done. Everything was stellar. No problems. And he said, no, Dylan, no, you've got to get a calcium score. And so I went and I booked it right after I got off the phone with him. I went and booked it. It was a couple weeks out and he told me my score needed to really be zero and it should be expected mine to be. And then I went and got it and I saw my score was 124 and he about had a meltdown when I told him and he said that I had to get and start talking to you and that I needed, you know, I needed three different medications that he told me I needed was rosuvastatin, Repatha and Vascepa, which I want to get into with you after I explain this. And I took it upon myself because I'm already knee deep in studies and research. So I was researching. And what I found was, is that for somebody like me, I needed to dig deeper than LDL, HDL, triglycerides.
Right.
So I went to the comprehensive metabolic and found that LP little a and ApoB, particle sizes, that those were the things that I needed to look at for right. my condition. Right. And what I found, my ApoB looked good, but my LP little a was 300 and it's supposed to be under 25. Right.
Right.
So that's when I started talking with him and came to you. And what we had found out was it's not affected by diet. It's not affected by working out, which, because clearly I eat perfect. I work out like a right. madman.
Right.
And it was probably genetic. And so what I want to talk to you about now, being that, you know, this was something genetic. And if I hadn't caught this when I did, I mean, you said it, plenty of people said it, I could have been toast in less than 10 years.
Right.
So what can you talk about the LP little a and ApoB, why they're so important and why they're not really looked at? And if it's something people should at least check at least once, just to see if they have this genetic issue, and, you know,
sure.
kind of get into sure. that a little bit.
So you're asking me my favorite subject here. So I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. So if I had to start, you started the right way into this journey. And the right way is to look for plaque, right? So that should be the first step.
Right.
And the reason why I say this is the LP little a, which I'll talk about, has been catching on a little bit, and people have been testing for it. And I've been seeing people that have elevated levels and have been very concerned by it. My LP little a level is a little bit higher than yours. My calcium score is zero.
Wow.
Okay. And so I don't do anything about my LP little a. So using us two as an example, you know, you develop plaque, and then that goes on to potential heart attack, strokes, all these things, as an interplay of two things. It's the biochemistry, all the blood work that we do, all of these levels that you're talking about, and your endothelium, the lining of your blood vessel. And the endothelium is a structure that
okay.
we don't understand quite as well, and we certainly can't measure it in like an office routine setting, right? You need electron micrographs and this kind of thing to study the endothelium. And the endothelium is sort of complex. It has this wavy, frondy structure above it called the glycocalyx, and then you have the endothelial cells and your proteoglycan layer, all this kind of stuff. But point being, you can have someone that has a very healthy, very robust blood vessel lining, and their biochemistry looks bad, but the interplay of those two things is not causing plaque. And then there should be much less concern about the biochemistry.
Okay.
On the flip side, and I see people like this all the time, you have people that have stellar looking biochemistry, but they have plaque. And so those people, by genetic factors, by, you know, old smoking history, by whatever, you know, a million different things, those people have vulnerable endothelium. And so we should be treating and responding to their biochemistry, even though those numbers look bad because they have plaque. So that is called the plaque-driven approach. And that's very important because, you know, when we talk about all these numbers, which I'm happy to do, it should always be in the context of what's going on in the blood vessels. Context is everything.
Okay.
You know, if your LDL cholesterol is 130 and you have no plaque, who cares? If you're post-heart attack, it's three times higher than it should be, because it's context that matters, right? So just setting that scene,
got
you
it.
Went about this the right way. You underwent your calcium scan, great screening test, and you saw plaque. So now absolutely important to dive down into those numbers and talk about them. So the first one you mentioned is ApoB, apolipoprotein B. So you have particles that are floating around in your blood that have the ability to enter into the walls of the blood vessels and form plaque. And there's a few of those different particles. The most common particles are LDL particles, but they're not the only ones. Now, every one of those particles carries a protein called apolipoprotein B. So if you measure ApoB levels, you are measuring every atherogenic particle that is circulating in your blood and can contribute towards plaque. Now, what is also important about that is LDL cholesterol is actually a calculated number for the most part. It's not even measured. But what it is, it's looking at the LDL particles and clumping all that cholesterol together and then giving a total, if you like. But you can have conditions where you have lots of small, dense particles. So you clump those all together. The LDL cholesterol does not look very impressive at all. But then if you count the particles, there's lots of them. Now, we have data, and this is actually from sort of Framingham, the children of the Framingham people. If you know the particles by ApoB and you know the cholesterol, the risk prediction will always follow the particles. And that's important because some people have a discrepancy, which is called discordance. And what that means, and you know, stop me if I'm getting too technical here, but what discordance means is you measure the LDL cholesterol. No. Hey, that looks okay. But you measure the particles much higher, much worse. So which one do you follow, or which one is more predictive of risk? Always the particles. And that actually works in the other direction as well. So you measure cholesterol, it looks very high. You measure the particles, they're low. Guess what? Your lipid risk is low. And that's important for people, for example, that follow like ketogenic style diets, because they tend to have a lot of cholesterol carriage per particle, but the number of particles actually is not increased. Now, in this day and age, it's even more important is metabolic syndrome, or more specifically, hyperinsulinemia, drives small dense particles and discordance. It actually creates that state. And so as we get further into this kind of tsunami of diabetes and all this kind of stuff, we're missing more and more risk by looking at LDL cholesterol. And we should be looking more and more at ApoB. It's a better marker of risk. And there is plenty of data that recommends ApoB as the best measure of risk. There's actually plenty of guidelines across the world that recommend ApoB, unfortunately not in the United States. But it is the best measure of risk. And so I measured in absolutely everyone because you miss the story significantly if you just look at LDL cholesterol. And you can get some clues to sort of a lousy ApoB by looking at things like higher triglycerides and lower HDL and triglyceride to HDL ratio. And, you know, it's sort of, there's a lot of nuances there. But sometimes all of those things can look beautiful and your ApoB is a lot higher than you would predict for that person's cholesterol. And, hey, if they have plaque, you should be treating their ApoB levels. That's what you should be focusing on. So that's the particle story in a real nutshell. I mean, any questions about that stuff?
Yeah, I do. I have a couple questions. So when you're looking at particle sizes on the blood panel, is there a way? So some of my particle size numbers were off. You know, how do you correct that? What do you, because my ApoB is really good, you know? I believe it was 67 and it needs to be under 90. It was 67 or 68, but my particle sizes were off. Is there a way to correct that?
Yeah. So, firstly, you know, looking where data is derived from. So Quest uses data that was derived from a town in Malmo in Sweden, right? So it was a very specific population of people where they took all of those measurements and then looked at, you know, which subfractions were associated, et cetera. So that's the first thing to realize is it isn't derived from, you know, across the world kind of populations. The other thing to know is that when advanced panel testing and particles and all these things were first studied, one of the first observations was looking at particle size. And hey, small dense particles are bad and big fluffy particles are good. And, you know, the bad is pattern B and the good is pattern A. As we've learned more about advanced panel testing and we know the particle count by ApoB, the statistical relevance of all of those other things actually largely drops away. So whereas it can paint a picture, I personally do not bother looking at any of those subfractions anymore. Because again, once you know the ApoB, you know the total count of particles that can be contributing to plaque. You know, good, bad, ugly, big, small, whatever it might be. And so that's sort of your North Star, if you like, is that ApoB number. And so I largely tell people just ignore that other stuff.
So let's just say, for instance, somebody does have an elevated level of ApoB. How would they go about attempting to fix that? Is it diet related? Is there medications that they need to take? What would be the plan there? And I guess it would depend on the level of how bad it is, but what would one do with an elevated ApoB to correct it?
Got it. So again, context being everything, if someone does not have plaque and you've had a proper look, it's not by a stress test or something, you've done proper looking and there's no plaque, then there should be less concern about that ApoB level. There really should be. Now let's take the other scenario of someone that does have plaque and now it becomes very important. You can worsen your ApoB and how it gets distributed by eating patterns that drive high insulin levels. So meaning excessive sugars, excessive carbohydrates, which will typically drive free fatty acids and formation of VLDL particles. And, you know, we get very technical here. But I also want to be clear that the data for risk reduction with cholesterol and ApoB reduction is exclusively with medication lowering of those numbers. Now, a lot of people don't like to hear that, but that's the data. So this is where the story comes back, where people get confused about dietary advice. And, you know, you have plaque, your ApoB is 90, let's get it down to below 60. Let me work on diet and exercise. Okay, well, you should be working on diet and exercise anyway. But that is an entirely different conversation when it comes to cholesterol control, based on the data. So exercise, extremely important. Diet, extremely important. And it does have a contribution to these metrics. But ultimately, the significant lowering of ApoB to achieve reduction in cardiac risk is driven by medications with the data that we have. Now, look, I'm also, you also want to be honest about what has been studied, right? So sometimes absence of data doesn't mean there isn't data. Sometimes it hasn't been looked for. But again, cholesterol lowering by diet and outcomes has been studied and has been shown to cause harm in randomized trials. So, you know, I like to be clear about people to separate out the idea of cholesterol and ApoB lowering from everything else in that advanced panel that certainly is the job of diet. Right. So really, if you have plaque and you want to lower your ApoB, the conversation should be about, hey, we have statin medication, we have ezetimibe, we have bempedoic acid, we have PCSK9 inhibitors, we have SERNAs. These are the things that have clear data for cardiac risk reduction. And people don't like to hear that, but that's the data.
Okay, perfect. Well, it's not. This is what I always tell people. If you want to actually learn something, you're not going to get what you want to hear. You're going to get what you need to hear. So, right. I mean, right. that's.
Yeah, I've sort of
got that's why you're here, because we want to know what we need to hear.
Yeah, and I've gotten to the point in my career where sort of it used to be a battle, and I've realized some people aren't ready to take some steps. Right, I always talk to people that we have a lot of facets that we can apply for risk reduction. Some people are interested in maximum risk reduction, all of the facets we have, and then let's talk about it. Some people are interested in the least, and they're like, leave me alone. At the end of the day, I feel like my job is to make sure you understand what you have and you understand what your risk is and give you your options.
Yes.
And if I've done that and people really understand and they make their choice, that's your choice. It's not my place to judge or to cram it down your throat, but at least have the right information about what to pick is important, right?
Absolutely. And I'm the type of guy, if something's wrong, as soon as we hang up the phone or I leave your office, I just go do it. I just go do it right then and there. I don't leave anything to chance. I book my appointments. I do it. Whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to go do it. But not everybody's wired that way.
Correct.
If something happens, but if you've got the facts and something happens to you, I mean, and you don't want to do anything about it, you can only really blame yourself, I guess, is the whole point, you know? Right. So,
right.
Go ahead.
You had asked about LP little a, so I'm not sure if you want me to pivot onto that because that's important as well. So lipoprotein little a.
Yeah, so that's what I want to go to that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So lipoprotein little a, it's genetically inherited, right? So you have a set point of LP little a that you will have or you won't. And the way to think about it is it's like a plaque-causing cholesterol molecule. It's sort of like an LDL cholesterol particle that is bound to something that has anti-clot breakdown properties, right? So it sort of encourages clot to hang around. So LP little a is actually quite common. About 30% of the entire population carries some degree of elevation. And the higher the LP little a, the increased risk of developing plaque, and also interestingly enough, narrowing of the aortic valve, right? So those are the two things that we see with it. Now, again, not everyone develops the problem. Myself being an example, I have thankfully good endothelium, and it's not causing a problem, but that's not true for everyone. In this day and age, diet has very little impact, exercise has very little impact. Some people are enthusiastic about niacin because it twiddles the numbers. I am really not a fan of niacin because niacin is an example of something out there that does all the right things to the numbers. And when you actually look at high quality outcome studies, it does not show outcomes benefit, right? So we don't just want to twiddle numbers. We want to actually improve outcomes. Just along that line, when I give lectures to the fellows, I give this example. So I say, there is an intervention out there that can lower your body weight, your blood glucose, your total cholesterol, your LDL cholesterol, and your triglycerides. So does that sound like a good intervention for cardiovascular health? It does, right? Well, that's methamphetamine use. So some lunatic studied methamphetamine use and measured these parameters, and that's what changes on methamphetamines. So the biochemistry of methamphetamines looks excellent, but of course we know it's atrocious for cardiovascular health. And so that's obviously a ridiculous example, but it's why you shouldn't stop at the numbers. You should stop at actually the outcomes. The numbers are not enough to demonstrate benefit, right? So coming back to LP little a, I'm not a fan of niacin. Now, there are drugs in the works where we know we can completely flatten LP little a. We don't know yet whether that translates into cardiovascular outcomes benefit. And again, the trials are literally in the works, and we at Hartford Healthcare are actually part of one of those clinical trials. The only thing we have at the moment are the injectable therapies called the PCSK9 inhibitors. So that's Repatha, Praluent. These are the two available. So those drugs cause increased clearance of all particles of cholesterol, including LP little a. So they can lower LP little a an average of 20 to 40%. And the actual trials that studied those drugs show that that does actually translate into improved outcomes. So again, if you have LP little a and you don't have plaque, that is probably should be of less concern. You know, keep looking for plaque at intervals, maybe a calcium scan every 5 years, which is what I do. But if you don't have plaque, there should be less concern. But if you have plaque, of course, now look at everything you can to modify risk, right? And looking for LP little a, which you have to measure specifically, it doesn't, you know, if you don't test it or ask for that test, it doesn't come in a basic panel. If you don't know, you will never know if that's one of the driving forces. And if it is one of the driving forces, then maybe you want to consider using a PCSK9 inhibitor earlier than you would, you know, not just trying to double down on statins and ezetimibe and all these other things. So that's sort of where it fits into the algorithm.
So What, obviously I'm on the Vascepa right now, which is, helping me also. Yeah. What is your thought on that? And what category would that fall into of medication?
Yeah. So Vascepa is fascinating. And it's also, it's a different facet. Its way of lowering risk is unique. There is nothing else that lowers risk like it. So it's sort of like an orphan drug, if you like. So what Vascepa is, it's derived from fish oil, nothing else to it. But it is one of the omega-3s of fish oil called EPA. That's the first important part. And the other important part, it is extracted extremely carefully to protect it from oxidation. So the whole time that they are taking the stuff from deep Atlantic fish down to EPA, they have nitrogen purge tanks. So there's not a molecule of oxygen available. And they purify it down over, I think it takes 4 or 5 months until you have pure EPA. And then they package it in a capsule that is oxygen impermeable. And then with a little bit of vitamin E so that it doesn't oxidize. So Vascepa is shelf stable against oxidation for up to 5 years. All other fish oils that have been studied have come up goose egg with cardiovascular benefit. Nothing. And they've done these really, really big trials with pharmaceutical grade fish oils. They've shown zero benefit. And in fact, some signals of harm, like 1% increased risk of arrhythmias, and you know, a little bit of bleeding risk, which is kind of overstated, but you know, not even just neutral. And over-the-counter fish oils, when they test them for products of oxidation, 100% of them are highly oxidized. And when you do lab research on omega-3s, these are oxidizing within hours. So one of the things that I feel very strongly about in the diet is seed-derived oils, polyunsaturated fats, I think are poisonous and garbage and have no place in our food, largely speaking, and we're awash in that. Drives all these problems, oxidation problems, inflammation problems, a very unnatural thing to be eating, right? And the problem with those is they oxidize and cause oxidative damage. Now, fish oils are about 20 to 40 fold, 40 times more likely to oxidize than fish oils. So these things are a tinderbox. So if you're eating fish, and communities that eat a lot of fish look like they do well, yeah, that's not the same as sucking the oil out of that fish and letting it oxidize. So you either eat fish or you take Vascepa. There's no in between as far as I'm concerned with the data. And the data for Vascepa is tremendously strong. You know, heart attack risk reduction, stroke risk reduction, all-cause death reduction. You know, the data for Vascepa actually looks like the original statin trials. And as I said, the way that it's lowering risk is actually completely different from cholesterol or anything else, sort of antioxidant, anti-inflammatory. We have imaging data that Vascepa added to traditional stuff can reverse or regress plaque. And again, by unique mechanism.
Wow.
So I'm very enthusiastic. And by the way, there is going to be some data presented at the upcoming American College of Cardiology conference pertaining to Vascepa and people with elevated LP little a. So there is some data showing benefits specifically in people with LP little a as well. So this is a very underused drug as far as I'm concerned. And again, something completely unique to modify risk compared to other stuff out there. Very strong data. I'm a big fan, clearly.
Me too. Obviously, I've been using it for 6-7 months now, I believe. So yeah, I love it. I do. So do you feel that the combination of Vascepa and Repatha is a very good combination for plaque and LP little a?
Correct. So absolutely. If you look at, you know, what specifically addresses an LP little a problem, it looks like drugs like Repatha and drug like Vascepa addresses that risk for sure. You know, we're also more likely to recommend things like aspirin or clopidogrel or one of these antiplatelet drugs if someone carries LP little a and they have plaque, because of its sort of anti-clot breakdown property. So there's a little bit of a clotting or thrombotic state when you have LP little a. And as I said, that's certainly not nothing. I mean, those are good strategies. But we also have stuff that in the next few years, we hope will translate into sort of killing this whole LPAA story if you use them, like completely squashing those levels. So we've got some exciting things in the works as well.
Yeah, you know me. I follow those. I follow everything I see there, the phase trials that they're in, and I see the results, and I have them sent to me constantly as a reminder from friends, and right. So I'm on top of it too. So I'm going to stay on you about it for information for sure.
You may just be an early adopter, right? Very good.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so I was talking to you about this before.
Go ahead.
Oh, we kind of, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. So I was talking to you about this beforehand, and I know this is a sticky one for a lot of people, but I want to know about this, and I want people to know about it.
Right.
I want your thoughts on statins in general.
Yeah.
And I want to know, because you already know this, I'm not telling you something you don't already know. They're very polarizing.
100%.
I'll be honest with you. I don't love it, you know, at all myself. And I do know that it has its benefits. But also, one of the things that I know that I want you to talk about too, besides your opinion, is that I know that it can actually increase your calcium score. It can increase your Lp(a) and it has side effects. So what are your thoughts on it? Because you know how a lot of people have their thoughts one way or another on it, just like how things are nowadays.
Sure.
Just break down for me your thoughts and what you think is fact and what you think is farce.
Got it. So one thing to be said about statins is they very clearly show cardiovascular risk reduction. Very clearly. That's the first statement to be made. You know, just to give you an example about this, there was this trial called the Woskops trial. They did it in the west of Scotland. They followed men for 5 years. They gave them a statin. There was benefit shown in the trial. They then went back and looked at that cohort of men 20 years later. So we had a 25-year chunk of data looking at, what happened to those men, both negative, both positive. Even if you took statins for just the 5 years in the trial and never for the 20 years thereafter, there was still benefit being shown compared to the people that never took it. And there were no long-term signals of harm. Worry about things like dementia and worry about things like cancers and liver problems. And, we didn't see anything like that. And there was benefit. And there's numerous examples of this, right? So primary prevention trials, secondary prevention trials. But I think the other thing to say quite clearly is statins are overused. And that's because they have been boiled down to be used for high cholesterol and not to treat plaque. And that's where I have a big problem with the use of statins, is we are over-medicating people for abnormal numbers, not disease process. And so we are clearly over-treating a big chunk of people. What we're also doing about statins, when I say we, I mean the medical community, is we're ignoring people when they have problems, or we're not actively surveilling people for problems. This is what responsible medication use looks like, is you recommend something, you talk about risks and benefits, you be honest about risks and benefits, because nothing comes risk-free essentially, and then if someone has a problem, you take them away, or you respond to that, reduce it, take them off at whatever it might be. So, unfortunately, as a sort of a lipidologist, I see a lot of people that have had tons of troubles on statins. So there's no question that some people get chewed up by statins and don't tolerate them at all. Well, guess what? We shouldn't have those people on statins. That's crazy. We're hurting some people with statins. But there are a large number of people that do just fine. And so you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and say statins are universally bad or universally good. You want to pick the right people to treat with them, and you want to make sure that you're not hurting that particular person with your intervention. And if that's true, then keep going, right? Now, the statins are also not all the same. So you have fat-soluble statins, you have water-soluble statins, you have different breakdown pathways, all this kind of thing. And so Yeah, some people will also do very poorly on some kinds of statins and do just fine on others. Having aches and pains on statins is, myalgias are certainly the most common side effects. I unfortunately see a lot of people, particularly older people, who kind of have aches and pains, and everyone's like, "Ah, shut up, you're old." And you take them off their statin, and they're like, "Man, I feel 20 years younger," because no one's bothered to sort of listen to them and say, "Geez, right, maybe this is from the statin." So I use statins a lot. I have a very low threshold to giving people trials off of statins just to check, if whatever's bothering them is from the statin. And at the end of the day, there's nothing too magical about statins compared to the other cholesterol-lowering meds. The final common pathway of all our cholesterol-lowering meds thus far are upregulation of the LDL receptor that clears cholesterol. So when you take a statin, you lower cholesterol in the liver, it makes more receptors. When you take ezetimibe, you absorb less cholesterol, your liver makes more receptors. When you use PCSK9 inhibitors, you're stopping the protein that breaks down the receptors. So that's the final common pathway. So what that means is there are some small unique benefits to statins, like a bit of an anti-inflammatory effect, etc. But at the end of the day, per unit lowering of cholesterol, all of these things are interchangeable. And we have such good and varied options in this day and age that I'm kind of a pragmatist. If someone arrives at me hot and heavy about statins, I'm like, I'm never taking statins. I'm like, all right, we'll try something else. Like, it's not a big deal. In my mind, it would be reasonable to try them. But if that is the breaking point for this person between lowering their risk or not, fine, let's move on. We've got other things. We don't have to be tied to statins, right? So, we are lucky in this day and age that we have options. And that's sort of my approach to them.
Sure.
The other things, neurocognitive, there's a lot of details to the neurocognitive stuff. Some people are impacted by statins with executive function stuff, be it concentration, be it sleep, what have you. It isn't, with the data that we currently have, it isn't any permanent or long-lasting damage to the brain or the memory. It certainly isn't risk for dementia. So the analogy I like to give is sometimes swallowing statins for some people is like swallowing a Benadryl for other people. While the drug is in your system, you feel kind of fuzzy and out of it, not like yourself. And as the drug gets out your system, you feel back to normal. But of course, if you get that, then hey, don't use that statin or move on to something else. Increased risk of diabetes is present with statins, but you're not powerless to that. Meaning, if you are taking drugs and doing nothing about your diet and your exercise, those people are more prone to go into type diabetes anyway. And those people teetering on the brink of diabetes with their lifestyle choices and genetics are more likely to be higher risk to be recommended statins. So the data gets a little bit skewed as to why there's a slightly higher incidence of diabetes on statins. But if you work on your diet simultaneously, which you should be doing, and pay attention to sugars, carbohydrates, you can largely completely avoid that risk. And so this is why a lot of these things are complex and nuanced, right?
Yeah, that's good information. I really, really appreciate that. Thank you for the insight. Yeah. It's nice to get an honest insight.
Yeah. But I'm respectful of the fact that doctors misuse a lot of meds, statins included. And I'm not surprised that some people get completely annoyed and throw in and lose their ability to lower their risk because they're like, geez, I've been mistreated for 10 years. Why would I listen to any of these jackasses, right? I mean, to be honest.
Okay, I love it. So I have a two-part question here. So the first question is, a lot of people have talked about natural alternatives, and one that comes up, and I think I already know your answer, but I want other people to hear it, is that red yeast rice is a natural statin, so to speak.
Correct.
Do you buy into that, and what is your thoughts on that? And then after that question, could you tell me the difference between a statin and a PCSK9 inhibitor, what the difference is and what they may or may not address, where one or the other may or may not.
Sure thing. So firstly, starting with red yeast rice. So red yeast rice is or has naturally occurring liver statin in it. So it is a statin. Okay.
Okay.
The FDA acknowledged that you can't have a sort of pharmaceutical product in a supplement because it is entirely unregulated. And so there was actually an FDA recommendation or request to take the active ingredient out of red yeast rice. So if you're getting a supplement that is exactly as stated and following FDA rules, it does not have the naturally occurring lovastatin in it. When they do batch testing of red yeast rice, and with the lovastatin in it, there is a massive variance in the amount of lovastatin per batch, even from the same company, from the same conveyor belt. That variance can be up to 50-fold, right? So because it's not as tightly regulated as sort of a pharmaceutical facility. So you get a massive variance if the active ingredient is in there. They've also found actual pharmaceutical statins in a lot of red yeast rice, like Lipitor, because guess what? The supplement guys know it works, and so some unscrupulous companies will sprinkle a bit of Lipitor into their red yeast rice, and hey, look at my cholesterol's down 40 points, right? And then the final thing to say about red yeast rice is that it contains a renal toxin called citrullin. And citrullin, it's naturally occurring, but it's not great for the kidneys. And the levels of citrullin in red yeast rice can also vary by 50-fold per batch. So, what I like to speak to people about is, why are you taking red yeast rice? And people say, well, I want to lower my cholesterol. Like, okay, why are you worried about your cholesterol or whatever? I have plaque. Right, well, you should take something that has proven benefit and is regulated and is not unsafe for you. No, but I don't want to take medications. Well, there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance there, because clearly you're concerned and you're trying to address something that you recognize can help, but you're doing it by a mechanism that's either a sham or the stuff you're trying to avoid and comes along with something that's not great for you and has a very high variance in what's in it. So I think why not take the thing that's highly regulated and predictable? I'm not a fan of red yeast rice for those reasons, right? The other question you had was about the PCSK9 inhibitors versus statins. So statins are an enzyme blocker. So there's a chain in your liver that ends up making cholesterol, and the rate limiting step in there is what statins block. Okay. And because you're blocking an enzyme chain, you can get sort of off target impacts of statins. But ultimately, the main intended impact is lowering of cholesterol inside the liver. So the liver thinks you are low in cholesterol, and so it makes more receptors on its surface to pull cholesterol out of your circulation. That's how statins work. PCSK9 inhibitors are a fully human monoclonal antibody. Now, your liver, when it makes receptors, it also secretes a protein called PCSK9. And the job of that protein is to attach to the receptor and actually mark that receptor for breakdown. So PCSK9 inhibitors like Repatha and Praluent are actually an antibody, fully human, that binds to that protein, the PCSK9 protein, takes it out of commission. And so your receptors are left alone. And so now you have many more receptors clearing cholesterol because they're not being broken down. So the very big practical difference between those two drugs is the safety and side effect profile of drugs like Repatha and Praluent is tremendously good, because they are so targeted and smart bomb, if you like, towards that protein. Just like the antibodies in our body, your anti-influenza A antibody is not going to go after your earlobes, right? Because it can't. It's a lock and key mechanism.
Right.
So these drugs are a lock and key mechanism just for that PCSK9 protein. So very, very clean safety side effect profile, and also hugely effective lowering cholesterol, 50, 60%. The statins, the most potent statin that we use will lower cholesterol maybe 50-55%. Not nothing, of course, pretty good. But those off-target effects is what potentially can impact some people, because it's an enzyme blocker, and so it's not, it monkeys around with more processes, if you like. It's one way to think about it.
So I have another two-part question for you then. Why is it that statins are why is it that statins are far more prescribed than statins? And I know insurance has a lot to do with that, but why are those much more prevalent? And which one would be better to take for somebody that has plaque?
Yeah. So per unit lowering of cholesterol, per unit, they both do the same job. Okay. So really all of these cholesterol lowering drugs can largely be thought of as interchangeable per unit lowering. Now, of course, if you take a statin and it lowers your cholesterol by 20%, and you take a PCSK9 inhibitor and lowers it by 50%, the PCSK9 inhibitor is better, but just because it's doing it more, right? But per unit, same benefit.
Right.
Statins are very mature drugs. They've been around for decades. We have a lot of mature data. They are cheap, and all of them are generic now. And so that forms a very big part about why guidelines recommend them, because we have mature data, we understand them, good, bad, ugly, and so those are recommended as first line, because if you balance all of these things, like number of people that it's available to and insurance coverage that people may or may not have, efficacy, all these sorts of things, that's why it's recommended as first line. But is it the best drug we have? I would argue, no, it's not, because we have drugs that are more effective,
right,
and much more better in terms of tolerance and safety. So, frankly, if it was me and I had all of these drugs on a platter that were my choice just based on use, I would use a PCSK9 inhibitor first line. I really would. But of course, that's not the way the actual world works. But, so that's it's not just a medical decision that drives the guidelines. Now, unfortunately, prescribers, doctors, have greatly underutilized these drugs and continue to do so. And I know, because I talk to a lot of them about these drugs specifically. And that has its whole litany of reasons, none of which are particularly good reasons. They are prescriber habits and inappropriate use of the drugs and worry about insurance and blah 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 blah. They aren't being used as they should be, frankly. But that's sort of there's complexities to that argument. But no question, they should be used tenfold more than they are right now.
Okay. That's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought. And I appreciate that. So let me ask you this. Would it be, so like in my instance, I definitely much prefer Vascepa and Repatha over the statin. Would it be okay to just take one or the other, or do you absolutely need to take them both? Yes. Yeah. So when you say inflammation, is that like on a blood test, like your C-reactive protein, like that type of test that tests for the inflammation? Is that what you're talking about? Okay. Okay, so let's just say, for instance, somebody wants to go about like really checking into everything right now. Like they've never done this. Would you say blood test wise, their first time through, like really dialing in, that they should get like a comprehensive panel that covers LDL, HDL, triglycerides, but then looks at like what we talked about, ApoB, LP little a, high sensitive, sensitive reactive proteins, like the whole shebang. And then possibly, because one of the things I wanted to ask you too, people that go in and get an EKG, for instance, or an echocardiogram, really doesn't predict much. I mean, it's a good test, but they need to get the calcium score too, correct? Okay. Okay. Right. Okay. Got it. Yeah. Absolutely. So, okay. So here's a good one for you. Now, obviously, when I found the plaque, I was extremely proactive. I went and got the CT angio. And so the CT angio was able to tell me exactly how much I had, where the blockage was, how much, all of that. So could you talk about the types of plaque? Because there's a hard plaque and a soft plaque. And so could you explain what the difference is there and what you need to be concerned about more so than the other? Right. Got it. Got it. Right. Right. No. Right. Right. Okay, cool. That's really good info. So, right. Right. Shit. Wow. So what causes the soft plaque to break off, and how do you get that plaque to harden so that it doesn't break off? Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Got it. Got it. Okay, good to know. I have one more question for you, and I know that you've been more than generous with your time, but I've got one thing left. So, and very simple question. What is your thoughts, or are there any good natural supplements that one can take along with whatever medications they're on? So I do pomegranate juice. I haven't talked to you about that yet, but I've been drinking that this daily. Is there anything else, like resveratrol, turmeric, garlic extracts, things, vitamin K2. Are there anything that you can supplement that will be of extra benefit to help? Right. Yep. Right. Right. Awesome. Okay, cool.
I always like to get a doctor's opinion on that as opposed to just like narrative driven, you know, written things that you read online and you read whatever people want to come up with. So I appreciate the insight. Yeah. Right. No. I'm laughing because that makes me think about the person that goes to McDonald's and gets a Big Mac value meal with extra grease and extra salt and then a Diet Coke. You know, like it's like it's gonna matter. Just go for the gold and drink the Coke. Awesome. So, Dr. Nolan, thank you. That was beyond insightful and more than I expected. And I can't tell you how appreciative I am and how much the audience is going to appreciate this. So I just want to thank you for the time that you gave us today, because it is greatly appreciated. Awesome. Well, everybody, I just want to thank you all for watching again, and I think you're going to find this extremely beneficial and highly informative. That being said, stay tuned for plenty more to come. Dylan Jamelli and Dr. Nolan signing off.